One strength of cinema is its ability to explore the whole range of human experience. And as anyone old enough to hold a driver's license knows, the array of emotions involved in that experience is vast. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Nathan Weinbinder and I will discuss not two or three, but four movies that, each in its own way, both examines and illustrates some aspect of human sensibility. So don't touch that dial, because another edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
When the news is good, it's good to hear. When the news is bad, it's essential to hear. You can depend on Spokane Public Radio to tell you what's going on, why it's happening, and to try to make sense of what it all means. People who are members of Spokane Public Radio, just like you, make this service possible. Thank you for doing your part.
I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor of The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that usually features three voices. But as she is wont to do, our resident law professor, Mary Pat Truthart, is traveling the world. So that leaves Nathan and I to fill in, which we will valiantly attempt to do. The job will be a bit more involved this week, as instead of two or three movies, we will discuss four films. One, If Beale Street Could Talk, we saw in the theaters, and the other three, Bird Box, Minding the Gap, and Support the Girls, we saw in the comfort of our respective homes, courtesy of either Netflix or Hulu. Let's begin by examining a movie based on the 1974 novel by one of the great American writers of the 20th century. That writer, for those of you who have yet to discover him, is the late James Baldwin. Already a critically acclaimed author by the 1970s, both for his essay collections and for novels such as 1953's Go Tell It on the Mountain, Baldwin oversaw publication of If Beale Street Could Talk during a period of particular racial strife in America. While Joyce Carol Oates, writing in the New York Times, called the novel a quite moving and very traditional celebration of love, Baldwin's novel also is a stark story of strife, both within a family setting and within American society at large. Barry Jenkins, whose 2016 film Moonlight won a Best Picture Oscar, adapted Baldwin's novel into a film that demonstrates just how intimately cinema can capture the human experience. His film follows a young African-American couple, Fonny is just 22, Tish barely 19, in the 1970s as they fall in love, brave the potential disapproval of their families when she becomes pregnant, and then must struggle harder than they could ever have imagined when Fonny is falsely accused of rape. As only he can, and as he demonstrated in Moonlight, Jenkins manages not just to reveal the lives of Fonny and Tish, but to pull us, his audience, into those lives as more than mere observers, but as virtual participants.
Well, Barry Jenkins was kind of in an impossible position here, following up a movie like Moonlight, which, as you said, won Best Picture and was also just such a stunning achievement. I mean, on this show, at least, we were all in agreement that that was one of the best movies we'd seen in years.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the best movies in the last decade.
Yeah. And so having to follow that up is a difficult proposition. But I think this is another stunning film, If Beale Street Could Talk. And he had another hurdle to clear, and that's James Baldwin, because I have read the book this is based on. And Baldwin is one of those writers who is really as concerned with his characters' inner emotional lives and their inner thoughts as he is about the journeys that those lives take. And it's often about how those things are at odds with one another. And I really can't think of a better filmmaker, at least maybe an American filmmaker, than someone like Barry Jenkins to adapt this material, because he manages, and I don't know quite how he does it, but he manages to capture the interiority of Baldwin's writing, but he does it in a visual way This is going to be a hard movie to describe in a lot of ways because it is such a visual film. I mean, just the longing in these people's eyes as they look at each other, and the actors playing Tish and Fonny, Kiki Layne and Stephan James, neither of whom I recognize from other things, but their faces are just so expressive. We talked about Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. We've talked about it a lot, and how the star of that film, Yalitza Aparicio, who is a newcomer, just captures so much, and just the way that she uses her eyes and her face to express all these things. And these two actors have that same thing. And just the way that Jenkins films them, how they stand with each other, how they occupy spaces, both alone and with one another, how they relate to each other physically, it says so much without saying anything at all. And there is a lot of voiceover narration in If Beale Street Could Talk, and a lot of it is taken, as far as I could tell, pretty much verbatim from Baldwin's novel. And I'm always weary of voiceover, but I think it works here. There wasn't much voiceover in Moonlight. That was a film that also used faces, and I mean, the actors are looking right into the camera,
right,
which is another gamble that I think pays off. But I think it works, and I think he gets us into the minds of these two people, both in terms of how they feel about one another and how they feel about the world around them that is rejecting them and telling them that they are less than human. Because this is a film, as you said, about racism in America as much as it is this really tender love story between these two people.
And that's what's key, Jenkins' ability to get inside these characters. You pointed out that there is a voiceover, and mostly it's Tish, who's speaking. And I'll quickly give my one qualm about the film, and it might be my problem, or it might be the problem of the theater, is that sometimes what with her speaking, and she has a very faint voice at times, and with the music, which we've yet to talk about, because Jenkins directs this film almost as if it's a concert film. The music is so integral to what is going on, we can't ignore that.
And the composer, I'm going to shout out the composer, because he also scored Moonlight, and that's Nicholas Britell.
Yeah.
And it is this lush symphonic score. I agree with you. It marries with the images so well.
Exactly. And underscores everything. I would think that some people could say it's a little much, but it worked perfectly for me.
Same.
But what I wanted to say was that sometimes I lost Tish's voiceover. Sometimes I could not hear what she was saying. A point that to me proves that the movie works so well is that I don't think I missed much. I got what I needed to get, I think, and that is largely because, I mean, movies are, I think, one of the best arts. You could argue that live theater is even better, an even better intimate experience bringing you into a project. But for me, movies are even better. I mean, they can push you away, and many filmmakers do that. But Jenkins specializes in bringing us into the film and making us feel as if we're a part of it. And this happens both with those loving shots of those faces filling the entire screen, beautiful faces that we can't get enough of, or it's even the scenes in which there's multiple characters. One scene I'm thinking of in particular is the one in which the two families come together, Fonny's family and Tish's family, and Tish is relating to Fonny's family, who is disapproving of her, that she is pregnant and they're going to be raising a child.
Yeah,
and
it's, while he's in prison.
It's an incredibly moving, powerful scene that captures the role of religion in the black community, the role of domestic violence in the black community. But it also underscores the love that Tish's family has for her and the acceptance they have. There's so much that's going on in that. It encapsulates the movie almost by itself.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about other individual scenes in If Beale Street Could Talk that I think are really standout scenes. But going back to just the way that this movie is made, because I think that's the thing that you're going to react to. It's almost like a knee-jerk reaction because this movie is just so gorgeous. And it was shot by James Laxton, the cinematographer that also shot Moonlight. And I was so enraptured by just the colors of this movie. I mean, the color palette that Jenkins and Laxton employ here and the production designers and costume designers is just stunning. I mean, you're looking at this movie and you're thinking Douglas Sirk, and you're thinking Jacques Demy.
Yeah.
You're thinking of Wong Kar-wai, who Barry Jenkins has said is one of his biggest influences, and a film like In the Mood for Love, which has a lot in common with If Beale Street Could Talk. But just the yellows, there's a running color theme of yellow and how it plays throughout, and the greens and the reds. There's this Mexican restaurant they go to, and the reds in that restaurant just pop in all of these ways.
And then
you know, you talk about the faces and just the way that these two guys photograph black skin and the different shades of it, and how gorgeous gorgeous it is.
Right.
I mean, this is
all played out against a movie that is largely shot at night, and it's largely shot in a dark apartment. Mm-hmm.
And the camera sort of swims around the characters like it did in Moonlight.
Yes, and the fact that these colors can be so, not intrusive, but they can affect you so much in an overall dark palette is, I think, amazing.
Well, this story is obviously, and it's sort of a running theme in Baldwin's work, it's obviously entrenched in real issues that are unfortunately still plaguing society today. And yet the colors have an almost otherworldly boldness to them. Mm-hmm. The real world doesn't look quite like this.
No,
and
it's
yet, dreamlike. And yet it doesn't have a distancing effect. It actually pulls us in a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then I want to talk about some of these performances. And some of these individual scenes, because Regina King,
Bill Street could talk.
Yeah, Regina King is playing Tisha's mother in this, and she is rightfully getting a lot of critical acclaim and awards buzz. It's one of those just commanding, strong central performances. She's sort of the moral bedrock of this entire movie. And because we've been hearing so much buzz around her, I expected it to be one of those big scene-stealing kind of performances. And it isn't.
No.
It's this really carefully modulated, confident performance. And she deserves all the acclaim that she's getting. But I wanted to point to Brian Tyree Henry,
yes.
who we've been seeing
from
a
Atlanta.
Lot lately.
Yes.
He was really great in Widows a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he has in this film what amounts to a one-scene appearance as a friend of Fonny who has also been incarcerated. And this is a scene right out of Baldwin's novel, where they're sitting around a table and they're smoking cigarettes and drinking.
And it's a scene that builds.
Yes. And it does play like a symphonic movement almost, the way that the camera and the music accompany this monologue that he gives about what it's like to be a black man in America at this particular time. The way that he plays that and the resonance that that scene has, because we realize that this monologue could happen in a movie set today. That sequence is one of my favorites of the
year. It's emblematic of the entire film itself, which is, if we had to do our top 10 lists all over again, it would be on my top 10 list.
I happened to see this before the end of the year, so it was on my top 10 list. And I think Barry Jenkins, I mean, we knew that he was a talent with Moonlight, but I think this movie cements him as one of the great American filmmakers working right now.
And if he keeps
putting out movies this good, he's going to be one of
the all-time
greats.
The question is, where can he go
from
here? He started this movie before he started Moonlight, and he stopped.
Yeah, he wrote them around the same time.
Exactly,
yeah.
But then he went to Moonlight first. We were talking about if Beale Street could talk, and neither of us can say enough about it. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the streaming service trio of Bird Box, Minding the Gap, and Support the Girls. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I discussed Barry Jenkins' powerful adaptation of the James Baldwin novel, If Beale Street Could Talk. Let's now move to a trio of movies that the two of us saw courtesy of the streaming services Netflix and Hulu. Let's begin with a Netflix original. Following in the tradition of last year's A Quiet Place, the Netflix offering Bird Box thrusts us into a post-apocalyptic world in which to look means to go crazy, perhaps even suicidal. Caught up in this nightmare, Mallory, played by Sandra Bullock, tries to save both herself and the two children in her charge by, among other things, running a rapids-filled river blindfolded. Though this is not the most original concept for a film, and one that has caused more than a few dim-witted people to get hurt by blindfolding themselves and taking the so-called Bird Box Challenge, Danish filmmaker Suzanne Beer manages to maintain a sense of tension throughout.
So it's hard not to compare Bird Box to A Quiet Place.
It's impossible.
Even though Bird Box is based on a novel by Josh Malerman that precedes A Quiet Place by several years. Not that A Quiet Place was that original of a premise to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
A Quiet Place was a huge hit earlier this year. I guess it was last year
last point. Year, yeah.
So it's in our minds still. And although I didn't love A Quiet Place, I didn't like it as much as you did. This movie's failings made me appreciate A Quiet Place a lot more, because that movie, for all of its flaws, was lean. Its plot had a clear objective. I mean, it was if you make a noise, you die. That was the premise. And it was just an exercise in ratcheting up tension. And I think the problem with Bird Box, well, I think the problems with Bird Box are, one, as just one of those end of the world, oh, we're trapped inside this house and something's outside to get us kind of movie. I think there are too many characters from the outset, because we're trapped in this house with not only Sandra Bullock, but John Malkovich and Jackie Weaver and Trevante Rhodes and several other people, and Lil Rel Howery from Get Out. And I kind of lost track of who was who, and I never got the time to know them. So we're just kind of sitting around waiting for them to get knocked off one by one. They're not real characters.
Right.
Two, I think that this movie is structured in a way that there's no tension, because we kind of know who is and isn't going to survive. And three, I just think the premise is so sketchy and it's thin. And I like that we never see the actual monsters, but
right.
I don't know. I actually didn't think there was any tension. I thought this was really long.
It reminded me more of M. Night Shyamalan's movie, The Happening.
It has a lot of that
and,
in it.
Come on. It's just stupid. Going down a rapid-filled river blindfold. It's just dumb. I thought that Sandra Bullock was good. I mean, anything, you know, I mean.
Sarah Paulson.
I think it's worth seeing, but.
Nah.
But
I mean, it's on Netflix. You can watch.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was Bird Box. Let's move to a documentary screening on Hulu that at first feels like a study of skateboarders, but becomes, as it progresses, so much more. Bing Liu is a 24-year-old filmmaker whose first documentary feature, Minding the Gap, captures the lives of the kids he grew up with in Rockford, Illinois, all of whom were skateboarders. But instead of being just another study of kids doing tricks and flouting authority, Liu delves into each of his friends' lives, revealing how they deal with such issues as domestic violence, child abuse, racial discrimination, and he examines what leads some to self-realization while others continue to struggle with self-hatred. Minding the Gap has won several film festival awards, and it deserves every single one of them.
And it's on Hulu right now, so you should watch it, because this is quite a movie. I'd heard buzz about it, and I just never got around to it. And when we were putting the show together, I suggested it, and you actually saw it before I did and kind of doubled down on the fact that we should talk about it. And I was thinking all the way through this film of some of the greatest documentaries ever made. I mean, I was thinking of Hoop Dreams. I was thinking of the Up series that Michael Apted has done for years now. I was thinking of Capturing the Freedmans. And that you're following this group of people over several years, and you see them grow in certain ways. You see them stay the same in ways, and in fact, maybe regress in others. And it's almost an anthropological study in a way. And yet, you feel so much for these people, these friends of Liu that he's captured. And I mean, it's about a lot of things. It's about, as you said, domestic abuse, but it's about how domestic abuse is a cyclical thing. And we see it manifesting itself in some of these young guys.
And it's a larger statement about America also, because because Liu includes all the statistics about how Rockford is a forgotten city, how it's lost any sense of production, of any value.
Absolutely. And the just sort of the socioeconomic climes of that place. I mean, it's about masculinity as well. It's about the whiteness of skateboarding culture, because one of his friends is black and feels alienated in a way. And I think that whenever we watch documentaries as journalists ourselves, sometimes we're frustrated. We've talked about it on the show, frustrated with filmmakers that don't ask the right questions when they've got their subject sitting right there. And as a film journalist, I think Bing Liu is really great. Well, I mean, he asks questions that I think if I were in that position,
I would have a hard time asking. Right. I mean, he confronts them with heavy stuff.
He flirts with one big question for at least a half hour in the film before he finally does get around to not even directly asking it, but he gets the answer.
Yeah, it's in regards to part of the domestic abuse that we're talking about.
And I wanted to say that the one movie that this reminded me of more than anything else was the film last year, the narrative film, The Mid-90s.
Yeah, yeah. And this movie, obviously, it's kind of apples and oranges because one's fiction and one's nonfiction. Right. But this movie does what Mid-90s tried to do and does it really well.
And in almost the same way, because there is a character in Mid-90s who is running around with a camera taking pictures just as Bing Lu was as a 13-year-old.
It ends in a similar way. You're right. But yeah, this movie, Mining the Gap, it's something. It's on the short list for documentary Oscars, and I wouldn't mind seeing it win. I think it's really terrific.
No, it's a terrific film. And that was Minding the Gap. Let's finish with another Hulu effort. This one, a look at young women braving the world of work. Lisa, Regina Hall, has a tough job. As the manager of a sports bar, she has to make sure each shift has enough workers, deal with potential theft, keep the sometimes rowdy customers in line, handle problems such as non-working television sets, all while putting up both with a demanding jerk of a boss, played by James LeGros, and the always pressing personal problems. Support the Girls is a kind of cross between Office Space and Coyote Ugly, and it's sometimes comic, but it's ultimately serious, and it's a film that many women, and even some men, can certainly relate to. Although I have to admit right here, I just didn't get the movie. You told me to see it, and you were really high on it, and I saw it, and I just went, what?
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Well, some movies you just don't get. I didn't get it.
Well, I love this movie, Support the Girls, and it's by a guy named Andrew Bajalski, who started in the mumblecore scene, and I think I've only seen one of his earlier movies and wasn't that high on it. So I came into this skeptical and came away really liking it, because what he does here is he takes the structure of a basic studio, R-rated, raunchy comedy. And you can picture the Regina Hall character being played by someone like Melissa McCarthy or Kristen Wiig.
Yeah,
and you can imagine the big, raunchy, gross set pieces that a movie like that would employ. And what Bajalski does here with Support the Girls is he grounds it in this real-world melancholy. I really believed that this place existed. It's called Double Whammies. It's a Hooters-type restaurant in suburban Texas, I believe. And I think that it channels a lot of the same things that the original Magic Mike did, because it's about these people that have resorted to using their own sexuality and their bodies to make money in a non-prostitutional way, I suppose. And they're selling chicken wings and burgers to these gross guys in this slummy bar.
Yeah.
But it's also about the socioeconomic anxieties of working in a place like that. And also the camaraderie that happens.
The people who work in a place like that.
Absolutely. And also, I love Regina Hall in this movie.
I loved her also. You know, I have to admit that for the most part, it's, other than James LeGros and Regina Hall, it's a cast of nobodies. It's a cast of nobody
mostly.
We really know. And they're more like real people than actual actors. And so sometimes somebody like Regina Hall will come in and it's like, oh, she's so much better. She blends right in with them.
Yes.
It's not she can't act. It's she brings them up to her level rather than sinking down to being unable to deliver a line.
Absolutely. And her character here is just such a generous person, and she's obviously being manipulated and taken advantage of. But you don't see characters like this in movies very often. She's a genuinely good person, and she just wants the best for her employees. And this movie just has such good feeling about it, even though it's about a Hooters-type restaurant.
Right.
I really like this. But yeah, you're right. Maybe other people won't connect with it the way I did. But
I think it's
low-key movie, but I think it's really good at what it's doing.
Yeah, well,
to each his own, I suppose.
Exactly. That was Support the Girls, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I discussed If Beale Street Could Talk, Minding the Game, and Bird Box. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenner for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot, on the radio dial, when we'll again seek out good film wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the late, great James Baldwin. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.